Good morning. The Senate Tax Committee will come to order today. We are really looking forward to having some discussion here about the fiscal disparities report. Whether you like it or you don't, it has a very big impact in our communities. And so there was a fiscal disparity report prepared, and I know Eric Ouellette from the Department of Revenue is here to introduce that report and discuss it. He's brought some folks along with him that can also testify. And so with that, Mr. Ouellette, welcome to the committee. We're happy to have this conversation this morning. Thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Eric Ouellette. I'm the Director of Property Tax Research at the Department of Revenue. This report was required by the legislature from a 2010 tax bill, and we'll be presenting it to you today. A couple of things before we get going. I do want to mention, if you hadn't heard, that the initial release of the report, there were some data errors in the report, so we reprinted, and I believe you have the updated February 13th version of the report. Apologize for the errors. It did change a lot of numbers a little bit, but it didn't change any of the overall findings that were contained in the report. With that, the Department of Revenue contracted with the firm of Tischler Bice, and Julie Herlins from Tischler Bice will be walking us through the findings of the report. Also with us is Carson Bice, the president of the firm, in case there are some questions that he would want to handle. Let me just do a real 10,000-foot overview of the program in case you haven't had to think about fiscal disparities for a while. Unlike a lot of features of our very complicated property tax system, the fiscal disparities program is a tax-based sharing program rather than a direct revenue-sharing program, and that does make it unique in our system and not completely unique but very rare from a national perspective. And Julie can speak more to that since she has more experience with working in other states. But how it works is every jurisdiction in the metro area, other than a few that are excluded from the program, contribute 40% of their commercial industrial tax base or the growth in their tax base since 1971. So if a community had no commercial industrial property in 1971 but has some now, they would contribute 40% of that amount to the pool. A community that already had some would contribute 40% of the growth in that tax base since 1971. So all that tax base goes into a centralized pool, and then it's distributed out to jurisdictions based on their relative overall tax base per capita, equalized market value per capita. So the money comes in based on the growth in your commercial tax base. It goes out based on the strength of your overall tax base. And because of that, some jurisdictions contribute to the pool more than they get back. Some contribute less than they get back, and the nomenclature we'll be using is the communities are either net contributors or net recipients from the program. So those are the terms you'll hear us using.
Mr. Ouellette,
yes.
Can you clarify for me the pre-1971 commercial industrial base is not affected at all? So if there were a community that was fully developed in 1971 and hasn't had any growth, they do not contribute. So the newer communities are much more affected by this than would be the older communities. Is that fair?
Madam Chair and members of the committee, that is correct, although any inflationary growth in the value since 1971 is captured, and because it's been 40 years, every community that has commercial industrial is contributing. I think other than a few very small townships and suburbs that have no commercial, most are at least in the 20% range for contribution, and most of them of any size are over 30% contribution. So because of inflation in values as well as new construction, almost every community of any size is contributing at least 30% of their commercial industrial tax base into the pool.
Well, and for members, I think that's one of the areas where we should be looking is – why draw the line at 1971? Is it still a viable place to draw that line? And number two, why 40%? Why not 30% of the growth or 50% of the growth? I mean, I think there are good questions. I would be on the smaller side of that, but I think those are some of the areas that we should be considering, and hopefully we'll hear more about that. Senator Skoy?
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Mr. Ouellette, I didn't hear quite right. This is only for the CI classification?
Madam Chair, Senator Scoy, the contributions to the pool is only commercial industrial and some utility property. But because what the tax base is distributed out helps cities and schools and counties reduce their tax rates, it has benefits or costs, or they have to raise their rates if they're losing tax base. It has ancillary impacts on all property in the metro area.
And Mr. Ouellette, there's also a fiscal disparities pool in northern Minnesota?
Madam Chair, yes, there is a similar program for the Iron Range. It was created much more recently in the mid to late 1990s, and because it's relatively new and there hasn't been as much development in that area, the amount of tax base that's redistributed in that pool is not nearly as significant as the one in the metro area, but it does exist and it works the same way.
Thank you.
And just a couple more broad comments, and I'll turn it over to Ms. Herlands. So you have this pool, and then there's an area-wide rate applied to the tax base that's inside the pool that's different than the local rates. So business property pays a portion of their taxes at the area-wide rate and a portion at the local rate. So the effective rate that they're paying is a blend between the local rate and the area-wide rate. And not for every community, but on the whole, the area-wide rate is higher than the average local rate. And because of that, fiscal disparities generally ends up having commercial industrial property pay more than it would if the program went away. And residential and other property pays a little bit less than it would on the whole if the program went away. Individual communities, as you'll see when we get in the presentation, have very different experiences. But as a whole, if the program went away, commercial industrial taxes would go down, residential taxes and other non-commercial, non-business taxes would go up. That's just to give you a sort of a context for all these, because you'll see a lot of detailed numbers, but kind of remember those big picture numbers as we go through, and I think that'll be helpful. With that, I'll turn it over to Ms. Herlands.
Yeah.
Excuse me, one second. Senator Hall.
Ms. Chair and Mr. Ouellette, I guess my first question is, could you give us the original intent, premise objective for this?
Madam Chair and Senator Hall, if you'll indulge us a minute, Julie will get to that
okay.
as part of her presentation.
Thank you.
Thank you. Ms. Herlands,
mm-hmm.
Welcome
Madam,
to the committee.
Thank you, Madam Chairwoman, members of the committee. It's a pleasure to be with you here this morning doing the presentation on the fiscal disparities program study. By way of overview of the presentation, what I'll be covering today, some introductions, we've covered that, and also about our firm. We'll talk a little bit about the study overview of the study itself and the approach we took to analyze the fiscal disparities program. Talk a little bit about the metropolitan area, the region, and growth trends in the region in general, some tax-based trends, looking at the fiscal disparities program itself, what has happened over time, and then looking specifically at what would happen if the program went away, and Mr. Ouellette mentioned that in his opening remarks. We also will look at the residential homestead burden, the amount, the percent of taxes paid out of median income today, and what would happen if the program were eliminated in the metro area, and then looking specifically at an evaluation of this question of overburden. Are these properties paying sufficient revenues to cover the costs that they're incurring? And then conclude with a little bit about policy considerations and some areas for future research. By way of introduction, I'm a principal with the firm Tischler Bice. We are fiscal, economic, and planning consultants. We specialize in what we call cost of growth services. we have a national practice, so the dots on the map shown on the screen in your handout are our clients, where our clients are located, not where our offices are located. And we have done some work in the metro region prior to this study. We specialize in fiscal impact evaluations and impact fees, looking at the cost of new development, infrastructure funding, and revenue strategies. And for the most part, our work is with the public sector, and about 90-95% of our work is with local governments directly. And so we bring that experience and expertise to this this project to look at this question of specifically about impacts of property taxes and the overburden question, which I'll get into in more detail in the presentation. The study itself, there's some main elements to the study. We looked at growth trends in the area, and I'll get into some detail about that in terms of population growth over time from 1970 to today, from prior to the inception of the program to current day. We looked at fiscal and economic trends in the Twin Cities area, and again, the fiscal disparities program trends, including this analysis of if the program were eliminated, and again, the potential overburden on jurisdictions. And a section in the report in the study on major policy considerations and issues. What it's not is it's not a program evaluation, and we were not asked for recommendations in the legislation that was enabled the study in our scope. So this is really what we've called a foundational document analysis information to be used for further discussion and perhaps future research down the road. The region that we're looking at is the metropolitan, the Twin Cities metropolitan area, and the region it contains over 180 cities and townships, over 60 school districts, dozens of other taxing authorities, but the fiscal disparities program covers the 7-county metro area. And what's shown on screen here and in your handout in the PowerPoint is classifications from the Met Council that shows that groups these communities by type of community. So whether they're considered a central city, which is the Minneapolis and St. Paul, a developed area, a developing area, a rural area, or rural growth centers, and that the color shading on the map indicates those areas. And what we've done in this analysis,
Senator Skoy.
Madam Chair, what year was that region developed?
Madam Chair, Senator Skoy, this is the current designation is the 2011 designations, yes. Mm-hmm. So in our analysis, we have looked at the data in three different ways. One is grouping communities by county, and so we'll have results by county in a lot of most of the analysis, and then also by these regional development classifications as well, and then finally grouping the communities into whether their status as a net contributor or a net recipient, and you'll see that as we go through. In terms of growth trends in the metro area, what you're looking at here is the top bar is the share of population by county within the region in 2010 is the top bar, and the bottom bar is 1970. And I'll go through the colors, which the county is which. So tracking from the left, Anoka County in the blue, Carver in red, green Dakota, the aqua color Hennepin, orange Ramsey, purple Scott, and the blue is Washington County. And so, again, the top portion is the share of population in the region in 2010, the bottom in 1970. The region has grown in population by almost 1 million people since 1970 to today. The current population is about 2.85 million. And as shown, Hennepin and Ramsey counties, while still the most populous counties in the region, do comprise a smaller share of the regional population in 2010 when compared to 1970. In 1970, the share of population was 77% of the total regional population. In 2010, that percentage has decreased to 58%, so almost 80% to a little bit below 60%. Grouping the communities into their regional development classifications, again, looking at 2010 and 1970, the blue part of the bar is central cities, the red developed areas, the green developing areas, the blue rural areas, orange rural growth centers, and then a small portion that's excluded from the fiscal disparities program. Population in the central cities has decreased from 1970 to 2010, and their share of the region has decreased from about 40% of the region in 1970 to 23% in 2011. Developed and developing areas have increased from a share of 57% in 1970 to 70% in 2010. Turning next to employment growth in the region, and this is where the jobs are located, not where the workers are located. So this is specifically looking at jobs. And again, we look first at counties, and then we'll look at regional development classifications. This slide, again, shows the counties with Anoka in blue, Carver red, Dakota green, Hennepin in the aqua, Ramsey in orange, Scott purple, and Washington in the blue on the end. As shown, Hennepin and Ramsey counties, while still contain the largest number of jobs in the region, their regional share has declined as well relative to other counties. In 1970, the share was 89%, and in 2010, the share has decreased to 73%. And looking at the employment growth by regional development classifications, again, the central cities in blue and developed areas in red, developing areas in green, there's an increasing share in the region's population employment in developed and developing areas from 1970 to 2010, so increasing from a share of 42% to 67% in 2010, and a decreasing share in the central cities from 56% to 30%. This tracks with national trends in terms of outward growth of employment base going from the cores of metropolitan statistical areas out to outer regions farther and farther out from the core. We next turn to tax-based trends, and we show this by the regional development classifications. Again, central cities, developed areas, developing areas, rural growth centers, and rural areas. And what you're looking at here is the share of the tax base, and this is the first slide, is regional homestead tax base, and the blue line shows the share in 1996. The green bar shows the share in 2011. And so the point here is that for residential homestead tax capacity, most areas have maintained the same approximate share of the regional total from 1996 to 2011, with the exception of developed areas, which have decreased by 9%, and developing areas, which have increased by 6%. And looking at the commercial industrial tax base prior to redistribution of the tax base for fiscal disparities, the central cities and developed areas have each lost 4% of the regional share, with developing areas gaining 8%. And again, this reinforces the development trends discussed earlier in terms of outward growth of employment. Turning to the fiscal disparities programs and the original objectives of the program, in response to the earlier question, there were six objectives indicated in the original legislation. And I'll go through these through one through six. That the objective was to provide a way for local governments to share in resources generated in overall growth of the region, as opposed to just locally, without removing any resources that local governments already have. To increase the likelihood of orderly urban development, to reduce the impact of fiscal considerations on location of business and growth due to the construction of major infrastructure facilities, highways, transit facilities, and airports, to establish incentives to allow for cooperation in terms of business location and without interlocal competition for business attraction. And to provide a way that where the area's resources can be made available through the system of local governments and local decision making, again at a regional level as opposed to at the local level. Number five, to help communities in different stages of development by making resources available to communities at early stages of development and then in redevelopment at when the time comes when financial pressures in those instances with those older communities where their needs are the greatest. And so, again, allowing them some additional resources to encourage redevelopment. And then finally, to encourage protection of the environment by reducing the fiscal the fiscal impetus to develop areas that are environmentally sensitive and to allow for protection of open space and parks. These six objectives have commonly been boiled down into two main goals: to promote more orderly regional development, and then to improve equity in the distribution of fiscal resources.
Mr. Lenz, just so we know, will your presentation get into a conversation or the analysis of whether those objectives are being accomplished?
This is the intent of the program, or the study was to get at those items, some of them in terms of the orderly development objective, or that aim, are much more difficult to analyze in terms of taking away the program from its inception to today. And what we've tried to do is look at growth trends throughout over the history of the program to determine whether there has been less or more of a outward growth for employment and population, but to undo the program and to control for all the other factors that go into business location decisions is impossible, essentially, because there are so many other factors that go into a business location decision, not just a local tax rate. Quality of life, provision, the availability of infrastructure. Different businesses have different location needs and criteria for which to site their businesses.
Ms. Herlins, in particular, I'm looking at number one, providing a way for local governments to share in resources generated by the growth of the area without removing any resources. And I think in the newer communities, that's exactly what's happening, is you're removing the resources they have. Mm-hmm. By taking out 40% of the growth in their commercial industrial. Mm-hmm. And so then the older communities, you might be protecting them because they mm-hmm. grew prior to 1971, but the newer communities with that 40%, you're actually making it harder for them to grow because they have to do so much more in order to take advantage of the growth that's in their community, and they lose the first 40% of that growth. And I'm wondering to what extent the information that you've gathered and the work that you've done to study trends tells us whether or not we've accomplished what I think are two parts of goal number one, either part, or whether it's actually having the opposite effect. And I didn't hear that in your answer, but is there a slide that's going to be dedicated to that question? Because I think that's the heart of this issue.
We do show throughout the report and in the study the impact of removing the program, and what that will show is that in some communities taxes would need to increase to make up for the shortfall, and other communities it would decrease. So you do by virtue of the simulation of removing the program show what's being lost by some of the contributor communities today.
But what I'm getting at, Ms. Herlins, is the cost to the programs to the cities that are part of that 40% contributor pool. Is that discussed in here? Or is it simply in the context of what would happen if you eliminated the program altogether?
It is. We have an analysis of what we call the overburden analysis of are there revenues sufficiently generated from commercial industrial property to cover the expenses. And so we do a simulation with the program currently. So with the program, so does retail and office and industrial generate sufficient resources to meet those needs of those particular types of to serve those land uses? So it is getting to that component of that question and that issue. And in some cases the answer is yes, and in other cases it's not, and it does depend on the level of government. And you'll see as we go through it differs by city, by county, by school district, because it does affect all units of government. And so it does depend on that level of government, but that is addressed in that piece of the analysis.
Okay. I'll look forward to it if you'll highlight that for us.
Sure.
I appreciate it.
Madam
Chair.
You.
Senator Rust.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I share your concern about where it is in this report that you can get that kind of information. And it seems to me that what we have the what here, but we don't have the so what in any place, and we don't have the then what. We don't.
Yeah, you're
They're
right.
not here.
Well said.
The legislation asked for recommendations. There are none. There is analysis after analysis. There is repetition of pages. I got really tired. I mean, three or four times I had to read the same information going through the report. Each section was introduced by repeating two or three pages that were in the beginning of the report. I didn't understand why that was the case. But, there is a lot of information here, but there's nothing that I see. And maybe in the oral report we'll find something different. But I don't feel guided as a legislator by this report in addressing any kind of policy directions for the fiscal disparities program. Maybe we'll hear differently, but I have to tell you I'm very disappointed in that.
I have the same concerns. I'm glad you raised them as well, Senator Rust. Mr. Ouellette.
Madam Chair and members of the committee, the legislation that guided this report did not ask for recommendations. If you reread the language, at least the way it read to us, it specifically stopped short of asking for recommendations about changes to the program. We focused on providing background information and some analysis that has not been done before, including this land use analysis and some other types of analysis of what the impacts of the program are.
I think it's pretty clear, Mr. Ouellette, that what we're trying to figure out is whether the program is working in accomplishing the goals that we set for ourselves when we passed it in 1971, and I didn't see that in the report, and I think that's clearly what was expected. I know there are policy considerations in the report, and I know we're going to get to those, but anything that you can do to help us get to the part of your presentation that talks about are we accomplishing the goals, whether or not you accept them to be our continuing goals, are we accomplishing these goals with this program? Anything you can do to jump to that part, Ms. Herlins, would be appreciated.
Okay. I think the simulation of removing the program does answer the part of the question about equalization of resources through communities. You'll see that looking at current tax rates versus the metro average, with the program, without the program, it answers the question in terms of equalizing, leveling the playing field, if you will, in terms of tax rates and what would have to happen to maintain the same amount of levy in these communities if you undid the program. So what we're showing here, and happy to take questions on specifics, but by county, looking at the impact of eliminating the program, both on the tax rates and the taxes paid, grouped by county. And so the top portion is the tax rates. And so you'll see the average of current law total tax rate is within each county compared, and we show the metro average area rate of 113.4%, and then what would happen if the program were removed. The biggest increase would have to occur in Anoka County at almost 10.3%, in Hennepin County a decrease of 3%. On the weighted averages, we also show averages of the jurisdiction rates, which does produce a little bit different results. But on the bottom portion is the taxes paid portion, that if under the current eliminating the program, Anoka County would see an increase overall in taxes paid of 5.6%, and Hennepin County a decrease of 2.6%. So in answer to the question of what's what's being lost and what's being gained, the taxes paid does serve to answer part of that question. I should note too that the top portion in terms of the rates, looking at local rates, county, city, and schools and special districts, the bottom portion are all property taxes paid, including state, and the portion that's assessed at the area-wide rate. There is also further detail in the report delineating between residential taxes, commercial industrial taxes, and total taxes. We're showing here just total taxes. In total, as Mr. Ouellette had mentioned, that residential taxes in the whole would increase without the program. Commercial industrial taxes would decrease in the whole without the program. Grouping doing the same analysis grouped by regional development classifications, rates would increase in all of the areas in the metro area, and taxes paid would increase most significantly in the rural growth centers by 10.5%, 10.5%, and would decrease in developed areas and developing areas. So this is the amount that they would benefit by eliminating the program. And then looking at the groupings between contributor and recipient communities, the decrease in taxes paid and tax rate would be experienced in the contributor communities and increase in the recipient communities. Slide 17 is not in the report, and we pulled out some of the top contributors and top recipients by dollar amount in each county, the top two in each county, to show what the impact would be, what would be what would have to happen in terms of the tax rates for individual communities without the program. So the largest net contributors are shown in the box with the green bar, the largest net recipients in the orange bar. What's interesting to note here is that even in counties that, even with net contributor cities, that by eliminating the program, because of the increase in the county rate in those recipient counties, those tax rates overall would increase. On the net recipients, all communities would see an increase in their tax rate. And then the final piece for the elimination of the, looking at the simulation of elimination of the program, is a point of information about residential homestead burden, looking at the share of income goes toward property taxes. And again, we did the simulation on current law versus without the fiscal disparities program. What's interesting here is that in contributor communities, the median burden would stay the same. Recipient communities, the burden would increase for residential homestead taxpayers.
And Madam Chair, I would just add that since these are medians, these mask some significant ups and downs on the extreme end. So there are communities where the residential burdens would change a lot more significantly than you see when we group it up like this.
The last major piece of the analysis gets to this question of are there sufficient resources to at play for different types of communities through property taxes and other revenues generated at different governmental levels. And so this is what we call the evaluation of overburden, this question of overburden. Is there an overburden by communities to provide services, both operating and capital needs for different types of land uses within these communities? So what we did the same type of simulation here, looking at what the property tax system is with fiscal disparities, and then what would happen without it, and are there sufficient resources at play here. This is what we call a cost of land use fiscal impact analysis. It's different from an economic impact analysis, looking at discrete land use types for the revenues generated off of different types of land uses. The big question here is, are there sufficient revenues to cover the service and facility demands and costs for each land use type? And is there a net surplus, meaning that there isn't an overburden? Is there a net deficit, meaning there is an overburden? The limitations of this type of analysis are, in particular, that it's an average cost type of analysis. So we've looked at average types of prototype land uses looking at a point in time, using budgets from specific jurisdictions to get at this overburden question. With our approach here on this analysis, we did not adjust other types of state aids and other revenues that would be affected by an elimination of the fiscal disparities program. So if fiscal disparities program went away, local government aid, county program aid would be affected, but we've kept those constant to determine what the impact is of the fiscal disparities elimination would be. I'll get to the results of our overburden analysis. We looked at four case examples to get some examples from each of the main development categories, a central city, developed area, developing area, and a rural area. And so what you're looking at here is the results of this cost of land use study to determine what is there an overburden for different types of land uses. And so what you're looking at here are results from individual jurisdictions. We analyzed each level of government separately at the city level, the county level, and the schools, and then combined the results in total. So the city's results are shown in orange, the blue, the county, the green, and schools, and the hatched is in total. The bar lines above the zero line are net surpluses. They're sufficient revenues to cover the expenditures on each type of development. If the bar dips below the zero line, it's a net deficit, indicating that there is an overburden to serve that particular average type of land use within this type of jurisdiction for that level of government. So. And there's a couple different ways to look at the results. One is from a local government level, where looking at particular results, where you're looking at results for retail, that at the city level, the revenues generated by that type of land use are insufficient to cover those costs, indicating that there is an overburden. At the other levels of government, there's a surplus. And in total, though, however, the revenues generated off of that type of land use do cover the costs. So there's the two different ways really to look at this are from the level of government versus a taxpayer and a property owner level, that there are in total that revenues generated are sufficient to cover the expenditures. So in terms of findings from this type of a jurisdiction, what we find are that single-family or residential units tend to either generally pay for themselves or generate slight overburdens. But on the non-residential side, retail at the city level does not generate sufficient revenues to cover their expenditures, but office and industrial do in this particular situation. Eliminating the program without fiscal disparities on the non-residential side, at the city level, retail still does not generate sufficient resources, but the office, industrial continue to do so. Institutional does not. Turning next to a developed city, looking at with the fiscal disparities program, we again look at residential land uses and non-residential land uses, and results are very similar to the first example, to the central city example. With retail development generally not covering their expenses, and office industrial covering their expenses, indicating there isn't an overburden, and institutional, again, not covering their expenditures. But again, the results do vary by jurisdiction, and in total, the non-residential land uses, with the exception of institutional uses, tend to pay for themselves where there isn't an overburden. Without the program, the results in this community, the tax rate would decrease. It's a contributor community. The tax rate would decrease, and so the results at the city level, particularly for retail, do get a little bit improve a little bit, but not as much as one would may expect. But in total, overall, the revenues are sufficient to cover expenditures. As you'll see, though, on the residential side, there is an overburden indicated across the board, where revenues generated from those types of land uses do not cover their expenses. Our third case example is an example from a developing city. And again, we looked at residential and non-residential land uses. The results here are a little bit different, where the city and county on the non-residential side tend to not do not have sufficient resources to cover their expenses. This is a developing city that's a recipient of the program, and even as a recipient, do not have sufficient resources for these types of land uses to cover their expenditures. In total, also, retail, office do not cover their expenses, and industrial, it does. If you remove the program, the results change somewhat for this community, where retail then is still at the city level. There's still insufficient resources, which is a trend here throughout each of these case studies. But in total, the revenues generated are sufficient for retail, office, and industrial.
Ms. Herlins, can you give us an example of a developing city that is a net recipient?
Mm-hmm. There is in our the full report, there is an appendix. Our first appendix has the list of all of the cities with their status as a recipient or contributor.
So, Madam Chair, just looking at the list, Hugo would be one example.
I'm sorry, I didn't hear you.
Hugo.
Hugo.
Marine and St. Croix. Prior Lake, North St. Paul, communities like that.
They're developing, so they're growing. They lose.
Oh, I'm sorry. North St. Paul was developed, not developing. So scratch
right,
so that one.
I'm talking about developing cities now. You were just referring to developing cities that have that are net recipients.
Correct.
And I'm trying to figure out what does this community look like if it's growing since 1971. 40% of its industrial tax base, commercial industrial, is going out of the city, right, to distribute to the pool. So in what way is it a net recipient? Give me an example of one that does that, and let's talk about how much it gives up in that 40% and how much it receives back. Can you do that?
Well, Madam Chair, we don't have all the data right in front of us for each of the cities, but in terms of the characteristics of a community, every community is going to contribute 40% of its growth since 1971 into the pool. So unless you have no growth since 1971, you're going to contribute something to the pool. The communities also all get something back from the pool, but how much they get back depends on whether their average market value per capita is above or below the metro average. So if you have a community that has had some growth, but their average tax base is lower than the metropolitan area as a whole, they might end up being a net recipient out of the program.
Madam Chair?
Senator Rust.
The narrative on page 32, which speaks to that slide, might be helpful, the last
Thank
paragraph,
you.
Where they talk about net recipient. They don't name the cities, but at least they talk about the characteristics of what would, of why that might be the case. I share with you the kind of the need to get a community in mind so that I can say to myself, oh, yeah, I understand that now, rather than an ideal developing community. Because I might say about one, that's hard to believe, you know, if I knew the name of the city. Why? And you just immediately challenged it when Mr. Ouellette named North St. Paul and then quickly corrected yourself, well, that's not one, because we would have said, what are you talking about? Yeah. And but that might be helpful, that last paragraph on page 32.
But I think it would help us all, Senator Rust, if we had that kind of context here. And I think that our testifiers are going to give us that context, so I'm looking forward to hearing what they have to say, because they're going to describe what's happening in their community and what fiscal disparities means to them. So we'll defer a little bit to that. I'm looking forward to your getting to the key policy considerations, Ms. Herlins, so we can hear from those testifiers.
Okay. Madam Chairman? I'll just quickly, so we can get to the end, the last example was a rural area that is a contributor, and results are very similar to the developing area in terms of the overburden question. But the trend here and the common theme is that retail development on the whole, for the types of development that we're looking at in this analysis, generates costs that are not covered by the current revenue structure, both with and without the program. This is the without the program slide. The findings on the overburden question really does depend on the type of development and the level of government. There's lots of factors that go into play in terms of is there an overburden on these different types of land uses, a lot of which are the life cycle stage of the community. Is there adequate infrastructure to accommodate new development, particularly commercial industrial development? It does also depend on your perspective, as I mentioned, in terms of the affected level of government and the taxpayer perspective. In general, overall, we found that residential and some types of non-residential development do appear to be an overburden, again, looking at these average types of land uses. And it's interesting, both under the current system and without fiscal disparities. So even on the non-residential side, taking away fiscal disparities still does not allow for coverage of those the expenditures, again, looking at average types of land uses. And there does appear to be more similarities and differences in terms of this analysis. We did not assume any kind of levy-back situation where there would be less revenue generated, and just assume that the levy would maintain the same. So there would be some differences going forward if the program were to be analyzed further. In terms of the policy considerations or issues that have emerged, this overburden question, again, really does depend on the type of property, levels, the level of government, the local situation. What's interesting to know, there's two points interesting to note, that over time, the school funding formula has changed over time, where at the beginning of the program, school funding was primarily a local government responsibility and has shifted to a state responsibility. And so that has changed the revenue need picture at the local level. And also that LGA and county program aid does include a needs component in their formula as it stands today, and fiscal disparities does not. And so that's an interesting a point and potentially a example to look at in terms of exploring further the needs component or the overburden component. The program equalizes tax base and tax rates, especially in the non-rural parts of the metro area. And without it, there would be significant increases in property tax rates throughout the region, and particularly in the rural areas. Rural area rates would increase in the metro rural area in the metro region would increase and approach the metro average. Rural growth centers are already higher than the metro average, but would increase that much higher without the program to maintain the same amount of levy. The effect on policy and business location decisions. This is a very difficult piece of the puzzle of the question. There has been population and job migration out of the Twin Cities metro core, and this has happened elsewhere in the United States. There's some analysis done, some secondary research in terms of Brookings Institution analysis, looking at decentralization of job markets. That places Minneapolis-St. Paul in the decentralizing category, along with about 50 or 60 other MSAs. There are others that have shown more centralizing tendencies, but the majority of the MSAs in their analysis have shown an outward growth of jobs and population. And so the question is this program contributed to that or prevented it from being worse? And without the program, would this outward migration be exacerbated, or would the opposite occur? But it's interesting to note that in terms of business location decisions and tax considerations, that a lot of times the higher level question from a business location perspective is from the state tax burden before you get into the local tax burden. And so there's a first pass of site selection process where the metro region is eliminated off the bat without even looking at local tax rates. So the question is really, how important is the local tax rate in the larger job creation picture? Without the program, more jurisdictions would see an increase in tax rates than a decrease. And also without the program, jurisdictions that would see decreases in rates have already been historically been those job growth centers. And so with a decrease in rates, would that further solidify their role as those job growth centers, or would it have an incidental effect?
Madam Chair.
Senator Rust.
Would you go into a little bit more detail about the second policy consideration there about why more jurisdictions would see an increase in tax rates and a decrease? Or Mr. Berlatt, either?
Madam Chair and Senator Rest, the area-wide rate that commercial industrial the part of the commercial industrial that goes into the pool, and they pay at the area-wide rate, that area-wide rate is significantly higher than the average local rate. So when you take all that tax base and you spread it on the local, then the rates just sort of generally rise. Not uniformly, of course. There's winners and losers. But there's an overall upward pressure on the local tax rates when that higher area-wide rate goes away.
Thanks.
Madam Chair.
Thank you, Senator Howe.
Madam Chair, your assumption then with this, though, is that there would be no change in spending decisions at the local level, correct?
Madam Chair and Senator, that's not our assumption of what would necessarily happen, but that's what we're illustrating to keep it cleaner. If communities that are losing tax base would adjust their spending downward,
right,
and communities that are gaining tax base might adjust their spending upwards, then the percent changes you see in the report would be moderated.
Right.
But this is sort of the outward extreme of holding spending and property taxes constant.
Right.
And we're clear about that in the report. This we're illustrating the most extreme scenario, but if there is this feedback loop through local decision making, then that would moderate the impacts.
Ms. Herlins, with respect to the bullet point number one, and the sub two, you're asking the question whether the job migration out of the metro core would be exacerbated if you eliminated fiscal disparities. And I thought one of your slides showed that Hennepin County would be a winner if we eliminated fiscal disparities because they are a big contributor right now. So I don't understand that question. Wouldn't they benefit if we did not have the fiscal disparities program?
There are, in Madam Chair, there are really two different ways to look at this, and we've had a lot of debate about that impact that could be, and that was the add-on, or would the opposite effect occur, that with a decrease in rates, would that make it more advantageous for those communities that would see the tax rate, and that potentially could happen, but the point about would this be further exacerbated is that it's already been happening with the program, and that there may be more competition, the need for those communities then to scramble to compete and provide incentives for commercial industrial tax base to make up for the loss in the fiscal disparities revenue that they're getting today, and that it does afford some protection, some ability to not as aggressively pursue commercial industrial development further out.
Madam Chair,
I did not follow that at all. I'll just be honest.
Let me take another run at it. Part of the assumption in what Julia was saying was, with over the last 40 years, some communities could choose a path of not pursuing commercial development and still receive some benefit from the area-wide pool to help, so they could opt then not to join the competition for this type of development. And in the founding of the program, that was one of the ideas of how you would result in more orderly development, because other business location decisions, location to transportation infrastructure and other sorts of things would by virtue of not having that tax competition as extreme, those other factors would become more important in business location decisions. So some of these jurisdictions that have chosen just to live with the revenues of the program rather than try and get their own commercial industrial development. And so that's kind of that part of the debate that she was talking about.
It should be
Let's talk about Hennepin County again. Hennepin County's property taxes, you said in your slide, would go down if they didn't have to contribute to fiscal disparities. And are you saying now that they wouldn't be working as aggressively to develop their commercial industrial property because they wouldn't have to because their taxes would go down?
Madam Chair, no, I'm not saying that. But if you think about Ramsey County and maybe the interior, inner parts of Anoka County where you have net recipients, if the program were to go away, they would be much less able to compete for business development. And that might be where the adverse consequences of development going further out would be.
Can you explain that? Why would they be less able to compete for business if there were no fiscal disparities program?
Again, holding just talking about the extreme example, holding spending constant, in these parts of the metro area, the program goes away, the local tax rates are going to increase significantly. So when a business is deciding where to locate, if the local tax rate differences are important, those recipient communities are going to look like a lot less attractive choice.
So you're assuming, Mr. Ouellette, then that those communities become higher taxed communities than they currently are, and that would not be a favorable climate for recruiting new business.
Madam
because
Chair,
their tax rates would have gone up.
Madam Chair, that's correct. That's the assumption in that. The city of St. Paul, for example, which is a net recipient, their tax rate would go up significantly if the program went away unless they reduce their spending commensurately. And there would be service implications of reducing the spending. So as a total, they would be a less attractive place for a business to locate.
So your assumptions are that the program would be ended on one day in time. It wouldn't be a transition. It would just happen all at once. And that all of the spending would continue and that those local elected officials would levy back all of the difference. And those communities would be very high-taxed communities, and that would make it harder for them to compete in the marketplace.
Again, Madam Chair, just to be clear, we're not assuming how we get from the current law to the alternative scenario that it would be a point-in-time flip of the switch or anything. We're illustrating what the tax environment would be like if the program didn't exist, but we held everything else constant. We're not saying that you would try to get there, immediately or over time or anything.
Well, if it didn't exist, it would be gone entirely, and there wouldn't be any
right.
kind of a phase or transition here.
Right.
Other questions?
Yeah. Madam Chair, if I could Ms. add Holland. Something on the point about the competition, then by virtue of the reduced revenues available, that there would be more pressure locally to go after that commercial industrial property base to make up the difference. And so there would be then a scenario one could see in terms of much more vigorous competition to augment the tax base. And so while they might be at the front end a less attractive business locale because their service, they have service needs challenges and the tax rate is higher, again, in the extreme, but that then the pressure then becomes more intense to make up for that loss. And so that then becomes this sort of additional consequence of removal of the program.
Madam Chair.
Senator Rest.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I think although it wasn't discussed a whole lot in the report, you were very fond of talking about dynamic scoring, of
right.
not holding, not just snapshots, but looking at how behaviors would change if that was the case, if we got rid of it. And it seems to me that what local governments, particularly cities, would do would be to use tax increment financing as their competitive economic development tool if fiscal disparities went away, and they would use it even more aggressively than it's been used in the past, particularly those communities that are net recipients, whether they made a conscious decision not to actually participate in the program, or Sunfish Lakes, the world. I mean, thank goodness there's not very many of them, that get the benefit without changing the landscape of their city with commercial industrial property, except maybe a gas station on the corner, and that's it. It seems to me that what might happen, or at least it's reasonable to expect, that the economic development tools that are there, tax abatements, tax increment financing, the grants that people use, et cetera, from the state would, for economic development, would there'd be a whole lot more pressure on them.
Madam
and
Chair.
That's where we, and that's where they go. But it's not. It's. I guess the only thing you can do is just to look at one thing and hold everything constant. But we know that in and to get a snapshot. But these systems are far more dynamic. We know because some cities go back and forth. Minneapolis goes back and forth between being a net contributor and a net receiver. So it's not, once you've voted to be a net receiver, you're going to be there all the time. It doesn't happen that way. And that's one of the conundrums of this program, in my mind at least. But I think the economic development tools would come into play here in order to get the competition, the competitive element between the two programs, and it would overcome maybe the higher tax rate. It's just a thought.
Senator Howe.
Madam Chair, and I had the same question about TIF. Is there an offset on the fiscal disparity for TIF or for, you know, like Job Z or anything like that? Because I'm thinking just the opposite. If you're a contributor, why wouldn't you use the heck out of TIF and why wouldn't you use the heck out of any kind of program? Because it really doesn't matter. I mean, I'm just wondering about on the competition.
If you get rid of it, though.
Right, I know that. But what I'm saying.
But right now. Yes.
Right now, I would think the competition for a net contributor would be, why not do these things
Well, I have the same question. There are some folks here from local communities that are going to speak to that question. We're going to get to you in just 1 second, Senator Skoy, but I wanted to point out the fact that we haven't really been talking about the net contributors here, but what's the impact on their ability to compete in the marketplace? Because every time they go out to compete new or recruit new business, the first 40% of the tax revenue goes elsewhere. And isn't that kind of a terrible disincentive to these communities that you got to work double, triple overtime to get any kind of positive impact on the tax base? Senator Skoy.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Senator Rest, I think you're heading exactly in the same direction I would. You would look at this as if it went away, and then what are going to be the ramifications of that? Now, all of these programs, this as well as the TIF and all these other economic development programs, are just their tax shifts is what they are. And you try to anticipate who's going to be shifted onto and who's going to be shifted off of. TIF and the other ones appear to be just on a smaller jurisdiction. I mean, it's the same thing. It's just in a smaller group of people. So fiscal disparities is taking that large map and doing this magic shift that's going on. If you do away with it, communities will find the TIF or whatever other program to do their tax shifting.
And yet, Madam Chair and Senator Skoy, that the accident of location of being mm-hmm. of a city being right on a major highway next to an airport where businesses really think it's kind of cool mm-hmm. to locate, should that the fiscal disparity should that be a should they get all the benefit?
That's right.
When you can't locate a major airport next to New Hope anymore. And even if we wanted it, you couldn't do that. And so that is, where the fairness and the redistribution of the tax base, that was one of the really pushes for this program, which I think is still admirable and valuable and so on. But we do have...
They do have an
policies in place that contradict one another.
Yeah.
And the economic development competitive policies versus this redistribution of tax base for orderly development is certainly one of them, whether it's TIF or something else.
And Madam Chair, exactly. I agree with that exactly.
Well, I'm so glad to hear your comments about that, because I think it seems like we pile program on top of program on top of program to try and accomplish the same things. And I wonder, at one point, wouldn't it make a lot more sense to go to one program that's more meaningful and more expansive than to have all of these different programs trying to accomplish the same thing? Senator Skoy.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Well, sure. I mean, you know, we can eliminate programs, but there's ramifications, as we learned with the elimination of the market value homestead credit. You know, people get happy or sad about eliminating programs, and so you should try to understand what the ramifications are, hence why these folks are sitting here explaining what's going on with this.
Well, no question, and that's why we're taking our time to look at this, because there are winners and losers, clearly, but there also is created a dependence on the state government to shift property tax wealth around the state, and then those communities become dependent, and then a transition gets even harder to make. And so that's why we're having this conversation and why we study these issues. Mr. Willett.
Madam Chair, just on Senator Howe's point, TIF districts are counted in the calculation for contribution, so you can't hide your tax base in TIF and avoid a fiscal disparities contribution. There's different ways of doing it, but mechanically the jurisdiction does have to make its fair contribution even with TIF.
And how does TIF work?
Thank you. Ms. Rowland?
Okay. The final piece, and this is the first bullet point, and the sub-bullets is what we've been discussing here about incentives and what would be the implication. And finally, the point about that Mr. Willett made about the homestead burden analysis, that is just looking at the medians, and that there are some more extreme examples, and so that could potentially be an area for future research in terms of the impact to residential taxpayers from elimination of the program. And so there's some more refinement in terms of the results there. And that does conclude the presentation. And thank you for your time.
Thank you. Members, I think we're looking forward to hearing from the folks that came to tell us what's happening in their communities. First up, we have groups of three, please. Sarah Erickson from the City of St. Paul, Jan Parker, Ramsey County Commissioner, Rhonda Sivaraja, Chair of the Anoka County Board of Commissioners.
No,
welcome to the tax committee. I know you were asked to keep your testimony to 3 minutes, because we do have a lot of folks here. We want to hear from everybody. We always welcome more outside of the context of testimony, so you're welcome to provide anything you'd like in writing to us and follow up and contact us and follow up, but we are going to try and keep to the 3 minutes today. So, Ms. Erickson, with that, welcome to the committee.
Hi, committee member Sarah Erickson from the City of St. Paul. My budget director, Scott Cordes, is here as well if you have any specific questions to the city. We'd like to thank the committee today, and I will be brief. We support reviewing tax policy from time to time to make sure that the policies are meeting their intended goals. We believe that this report suggests that, by and large, the fiscal disparities program is working and meeting its two primary goals. The first goal being to promote more orderly regional development. The study suggests that many businesses, in addition to looking at the expansion of tax base, are making decisions about where to locate on factors such as placemaking, commute times, and quality of life. Furthermore, it suggests that fiscal disparities encourages businesses to locate based on business needs rather than incentives provided by its host community. The second goal is improving equity in the distribution of fiscal resources. The study also outlines that, in general, the elimination of fiscal disparities program would grossly impact recipient communities and only slightly benefit cities who contribute. The study suggests that net contributors would see a decrease of less than 2.5% in the overall tax rate, while the net recipients would see an increase of over 8% in their overall tax rate. At this time, the city is requesting no changes to be made to the fiscal disparities program, as this program needs to be looked at in the larger context of state tax policy. We appreciate this committee's time and look forward to answering any questions.
Thank you, Ms. Erickson.
Ms. Parker?
I'm not sure who's chairing now.
I guess I
okay,
am right
thank
now.
Thank you.
Ms. Parker.
Chair. Madam Chair, members of the committee, I'm Jan Parker. I'm a Ramsey County Commissioner, and I appreciate the opportunity to address you this morning. I also want to mention that Stephen Baker, our county assessor, is in the audience, and if you have any detailed questions, I'm sure he'd be happy to help you. Ramsey County is the smallest county in the state geographically. We are almost fully developed, aside from a couple of brownfields, so we don't have the kind of opportunities for growth that most of the counties in the state have. As home to state office buildings, many hospitals, many churches, many colleges, both public and private, who do not pay taxes, 36.5% of the county's land area is, and 25% of the estimated market value are tax exempt. Okay, just think about that. Fiscal disparities is important for financing services provided to the citizens of Ramsey County, and its absence would increase property taxes for homeowners in the county and most taxpayers in general, but all homeowners. It's important, as Senator Rest had mentioned, to look at the level of the tax burden in addition to the change that would result. Our tax burden is already higher than the average. Two purposes of fiscal disparity are to improve the equity in the distribution of physical resources and to promote better regional planning. We can't all have a regional airport. That makes a big, big difference in the tax rates. Fiscal disparities has played a role in diminishing some of the competition for commercial industrial development to preserve the regional natural resources. And I urge you, along with my colleagues here, to defer making changes in this program until you really have carefully considered all the ramifications and unintended consequences. It would have a major negative effect on Ramsey County. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Parker. Ms. Saraja?
Good morning, Madam Chair, members of the committee. Thank you for the opportunity to testify today. My name is Rhonda Sivaraj, and I'm chair of the Anoka County Board of Commissioners. And to truly understand the importance of fiscal disparities, I think it's also important to take a look at the environment in which it was created. It was actually created 40 years ago. In 1971, there was actually no political designation on the ballot. And so overall, though, unless you represented the core cities of Minneapolis and St. Paul, you represented a community that was really sparsely populated and really struggling to grow and have its own identity. This is at a time when 70% of the metro's population still lived in Minneapolis and St. Paul. Over the years, growth tended to gravitate where state infrastructure investments were made, primarily in transportation. The communities who are considered net contributors keep 60% of the growth in their commercial industrial tax base. And it's important to note that although the study focused on the impact on cities and counties, school districts are also impacted. In Anoka County, even though the city of Blaine, for example, is a net contributor, those residents that live in those communities actually end up being net recipients because the county and school district are recipients. So when you look at the overall tax burden combined, they actually are beneficiaries. We understand that in Anoka County, we actually play two very key roles within the metropolitan area. Anoka County is primarily a bedroom community, not by choice, not because we haven't tried to attract businesses to the area, but really a lot of it has to do with the some other factors that I'll outline later. And so part of the important role that we play is supplying a part of the workforce for those commercially developed areas. And in order for our region to be healthy and compete on a global basis, that workforce needs to be educated, so being able to provide those core services is critical. Another element to consider is the impact on natural resources. In Anoka County, I cannot overstate the importance of protecting our natural areas and open spaces because those open plains provide a key element for the entire Twin Cities area. Let me explain. Anoka County has three rivers, more than 143 lakes, and more than 75,000 acres of wetland within our 444 square miles of sandy soil. That moist and sandy soil is like a giant sieve, and beneath it is an aquifer. It takes approximately 10 years for one drop of water to actually reach that aquifer. That sand plain aquifer is the largest supplier of our Twin Cities groundwater. So we are upstream, and we are your water supply. Severe changes to fiscal disparities or elimination altogether could mean rushed development in order to maintain support for public services. That means that there'd be a lot of pavement, a lot of runoff to the Mississippi River, and that groundwater supply would definitely be impacted. In addition to the 75,000 acres of wetland, we actually have almost 22,000 acres of DNR-owned property in Anoka County as well.
I'm going to ask you that. We have a lot of other testifiers.
Okay. So
absolutely.
Wrap
Thank it up.
You.
Thank you.
And so I guess my final, my message to you is that not to change the program in isolation, but really would encourage you to take a look at comprehensive property tax reform, because what you do in this area will impact LGA, outstate Minnesota, and so forth. So, again, it would encourage comprehensive property tax reform. Thank you.
Thank you. We'll have the next group come up, Mr. Carlson, Mr. Lundell, and Ms. Nauman.
Mr. Carlson, welcome.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, thank you very much. I want to, as a school district, lend our support to the fiscal disparities legislation as it is today. If it was taken away, our property taxes would increase by about 10%. We just passed a $48 million levy. That would be difficult to pass if our taxes were increased by 10%. We barely passed a $3 million technology levy that was a very small impact and with a very small margin. So if the property taxes went up by 10%, it would be a serious blow to our ability to pass that. Let me add to Commissioner Sivaraja's demographic information. We have the lowest per capita income in the seven-county metro area and the lowest percent of adults with a college degree. Every weekday, on a day like today, we send 90,000 workers into the Twin Cities to work in businesses and corporations all around the metro area to build their commercial industrial tax base. Of only the communities in which those business and corporations reside. As a result, our residents get to return home and pay a much greater portion of their taxes in a school referendum levy, sometimes as much as 2 or 3%, as, for example, the suburban West, to get their children educated to join this same workforce. Fiscal disparities works to level the playing field for the Anoka-Hennepin students and families. Fiscal disparities works if you are trying to educate the workforce in a demographic areas like ours that is poor and somewhat uneducated at the college level. And our students, as much as anyone, need a post-secondary education and a college degree to supply the workforce for the metro area in the next decade. We remain strong supporters of the legislation as it is today. It works as it was designed to work, and it helps us a great deal. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Carlson. Mr. Lundell.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, Brad Lundell with Schools for Equity in Education. We represent 61 school districts statewide. 15 of those are in the metropolitan area and are outer ring lower property wealth school districts. Echoing Mr. Carlson's comments, I think that the fiscal disparities, if changes are to be made with that, as others have said, to tread carefully. Mr. Carlson talked about the property tax sensitivity that exists in low property wealth districts, and especially in the metropolitan area where you have many low property wealth districts that adjoin high property wealth districts, the tax disparities that result as those differences in property wealth are very, very real and create very, very great inequities between school districts, both in terms of the amount of money they can raise through the referendum and also then the resulting tax effort. There's a handout that I've had distributed it's a little bit apples and oranges, but at least I've stayed in the produce section. So I guess that's the thing I would say, that we're looking at metropolitan district referendum data, and if you look three columns, the referendum revenue per pupil, the tax burden per $100,000 of value, and then I've created this ratio that shows how much taxing power you have. And you can see in the case of Anoka-Hennepin, they're raising a little over $1,200 for $292 per $100,000 of value. You go up to the places that are net contributors, places like St. Louis Park, you can see $500, $600 more for $100 less in burden per $100,000 of value. Again, this is not, this is a different tax base than fiscal disparities. The referendum market value is different than the ANTC, but I think that this does show the property tax sensitivity that does exist, and fiscal disparities does help mitigate some of those property tax differences. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Lundell. Ms. Nauman, welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My name again is Patricia Nauman. I'm the Executive Director of Metro Cities. We are a member-based organization that represents cities throughout the seven-county metropolitan area before both the legislature and the Metropolitan Council. As you can imagine, there is a keen interest by our members in the fiscal disparities program and in this study in particular. Metro Cities policies have long supported the fiscal disparities program. We've also long opposed having this program having the proceeds from the program be used for any specific programs in the metropolitan area. Using our policies as a backdrop, and while I'm not in a position today to forecast what might come out in terms of any policy changes for our organization as the result of this study, I do believe that the study provides some very important analysis and a foundation from which we will go forward to use in determining what policies our organization might develop around fiscal disparities in the future. We will, of course, be closely monitoring what the legislature might do in terms of any proposals or thinking around the fiscal disparities program and any changes. And to that end, I would encourage you, as other testifiers had, to undertake those discussions and any proposals and ideas with the understanding and with the underpinning that the fiscal disparities program does exist within the context of other state aid programs and property tax policies. So we would strongly encourage you to undertake any discussions within that framework. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Ms. Nauman. Before you go, Senator Cruz.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and I don't want to, I sit on this, I don't sit on this committee, so I just wanted to say thank you for allowing a couple of us who have interest in this to sit at the table and ask questions. My question is actually for Mr. Carlson, if he would be so kind. I look at this report, and the premise of it is that all of these levies are held harmless, that they would stay the same, and that's where the analysis comes from. And as it's already been brought up, we know that that's not the case, that these levies will shift, these dollars will shift. I know in particular, Mr. Carlson, in your school district, like you mentioned, we've had to work very hard at continuing to keep those levies as is. If we do have a increase in our tax burden at the municipal level or the county level, as much as our communities already do a phenomenal job trying to keep those low, my concern would be that some of that would be pulled away from any potential education levies. If you have to do the day-to-day operations stuff, I'm concerned that the education levy would suffer. My question to you is this. As far as a return on investment for those dollars, whether they be put into day-to-day operations of our counties and our cities compared to education, could you speak a little bit to that?
Madam Chair, Senator Cruz, I think, first of all, to the Chair's earlier comments, if you adequately fund education, I don't sit here. You know, if you change the whole framework of everything and fund us the way school districts should fund it, I'm not going to be in front of this tax committee making this testimony to the fiscal disparities. In the case of our property tax owners, when they get their bill, they just look at the number. They don't get all the nuances of who gets taxed what. So any impact to us on taxes, and in this one, it'd be a 10% increase. I doubt we'd have passed any levy. Then we're $48 million out. We lose 568 teachers, as I recall. And we are not going to be competitive, and our kids are going to suffer dearly. With the good legislation that we had last session, for example, with the literacy growth and proficiency money that Senator Jen Olson spearheaded, we took that money and invested it in our four-year-old program, double the size of that, and tripled the size of our all-day kindergarten program. So to your point, yes, we would reinvest it, but that's the way our kids are going to be competitive in this next workforce of the next decade.
Members, we do need to move on to Councilman Keeley, Ms. Johnston, Councilman Hulting. Senator Bach.
Well, this is for Ms. Nauman, I think. And maybe that she said something that...
Folks, come on up.
Ms. Nauman said something that triggered my recollection. You said that you opposed the legislature tapping any of the funds. Has the fiscal disparities pool ever been tapped in the past? And if it was it ever paid back?
Ms. Nauman.
And maybe the department might be better to answer that. But
I would defer some of that to the department. I can tell you my recollection of our policy comes out of a proposal to use some of that money. From my understanding, this is before my time with the organization, but using it for the Hennepin County Medical Center, if I recall. I believe that was the impetus for our policy. But maybe the department can speak to
Mr. Willett, do you have an answer to that question?
There's more.
Madam Chair, Senator Bach, off the top of my head, there is a $5 million fund that the Met Council does for Livable Communities Act that comes out of the pool. The study was paid for out of the fund, which is a very small one, but there was also a special provision for infrastructure for the Mall of America that was sort of a temporary loan out of the fund, and now Bloomington had gotten that paid for out of the fund, and now they're making a larger contribution each year to pay that back. So that was more of a loan than a because they are paying extra now, whereas they were getting money out of the pool earlier to pay the bonds off for the highway infrastructure around the Mall of America.
Thank you.
Madam Chair, Mr. Willett, wasn't it like $48 million or something like that? And I don't know how much of it's been paid back, but
Madam Chair, Senator Bach, I don't remember the dollar amounts, but my recollection on the payback schedule is that it's supposed to be done in about 4 years, so they're a little more than half through the payback period, if my recollection's right.
Thank you. Councilman Keeley, welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Madam Chair, members of the committee, thank you for having me to talk about the impacts of fiscal disparities on the city of Burnsville and with the recent study of the program. My community has been one of the contributors since the program's creation. Our 2011 net fiscal disparities contribution was $2.8 million, slightly higher than in 2010. The City of Burnsville has long advocated for meaningful review of the present-day applicability of the state's 1971 commercial industrial tax base sharing law. We have long opposed the use of the fiscal disparities to fund social or fiscal metropolitan programs because of a fundamental lack of transparency. In effect, due to the complexity of the fiscal complexities formula, it amounts to a metropolitan-wide property tax increase that is largely hidden from the public. We applaud the legislature for undertaking this review. It is critically important to look at all programs in the state to determine if they're serving the public as originally intended. The report states the purpose of the program is to promote more orderly regional development and to improve equity in the distribution of fiscal resources. Unfortunately, the report does not reach any definitive conclusions as to whether these goals are being met through the existing program. The report does not present clear data that the program is serving its purpose. If the program is not meeting its stated intent, it would seem as though the program's existence perpetuates needless complexity in an already complex tax code. Complexity is not necessarily a bad thing, as long as there is a clear benefit to it. That does not seem to be the case here. Now, in these difficult financial times, it is important that we are being transparent about how taxpayer resources are being spent. One way to improve that transparency is to eliminate complexities in the tax law, unless compelling evidence exists that it is serving the stated public purpose. Thank you.
Councilman Hulting. Councilman. Thank you. And we also have Councilman Halting from Bloomington. Welcome.
Yes, ma'am. Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, committee members. I'll note that I speak for myself. For some time, frankly, I have perceived both bodies of our Minnesota legislature as being the state's custodians of honor. I believe that you set the standards and the tone by which the rest of us deal with one another. Once again, I perceive you to be the custodians of honor in Minnesota. Conversely, the rule of 71, that is the cornerstone for fiscal disparities calculations, is, in my view, fundamentally dishonest and unfair. It's one thing to redistribute tax dollars from one jurisdiction to another, assuming a level playing field or the same rules applying to everyone. It is patently dishonest, again in my view, to apply a 40-year-old standard plus inflation as a component to one jurisdiction's CI calculation, again plus inflation, and another 40-year more current plus inflation calculation to a neighboring jurisdiction. Presently, net recipients of fiscal disparities dollars outnumber net contributors by about a 60-40 spread. That said, and understanding political will, a 60% to 40% might is right paradigm is simply not, again, in my view, an honest basis for redistribution of taxpayer, hardworking taxpayer dollars. Whether CI-based dollars or the individual homestead owner's tax dollars that have to be attached in order to make up for the loss, the unfair and dishonest loss, again, in my view, of fiscal disparities, CI tax dollars. It is the case, as was mentioned earlier, that a number of communities, many of them less urban and more rural, exist to a large degree as bedroom communities. Or jurisdictions where residents move to simply because they don't want smokestacks in their backyard or noisy highways and freeways or even gunshots once a week or more. In short, a robust CI base is not one of their quality of life prerequisites. And as such, they and many of the jurisdictions in place since the implementation of fiscal disparities 40 years ago simply prefer that their development revenue requirements be perpetually borne by someone else. Once again, it is one thing, in my view, to redistribute tax dollars from one taxing jurisdiction to another. It is quite another to do so with a formula wherein the individual jurisdictions play by different rules based on the rule of 71. Thank you.
Thank you, Councilman. We have Ms. Johnston. Did you want to testify as well, Ms. Johnston?
Madam Chair, Heather Johnston, the CFO and Director of Administrative Services for the City of Burnsville. Actually, Councilmember Keeley gave our testimony. The only thing that I would add to that is regarding the development competition, as we were discussing it earlier, is really more a state-to-state competition as opposed to the regional competition that it may have been back in 1971. And so that would be the only thing I would add to the conversation. Thank you.
Thank you. And do we have someone from the North Metro Mayor Association? I'm sorry, we didn't have your name, sir. Please join us at the table, and Councilman, maybe you can make room for him. Thank you.
Thank you, Chair. Members of the committee, my name is Mike Gamash. I am currently the mayor of the city of Andover. I've been mayor for 11 years now, also employed at General Mills. I serve as the president of North Metro Mayors Association, and I'm here today to testify on behalf of the study of the Metropolitan Area Fiscal Disparities Program. The North Metro Mayors was established in 1987. It's a joint powers organization. We represent 17 cities in our membership and also have memberships with Anoka and Hennepin County, as well as numerous private sector partners. We believe that the program has been a significant success for our cities and our property taxpayers. This is more significant today given that our cities have a greater loss of total property tax or total tax capacity than other metro and greater Minnesota cities due to the weakened economy and the housing markets. Brooklyn Center and Crystal, for example, have seen their total tax capacity drop by 20% from 2008 to 2011, compared to 7% for all Minnesota cities. Fiscal disparities helps to overcome this challenge. In a very real sense, the entire region is needed to foster an economic development. That is one reason why we applaud the current efforts to think as a region on job creation and competition with other regions. But local governments throughout the region bear the cost of successful economic development regardless of where the development happens to occur. The city in which it is located bears the cost associated with property services such as police and fire. But workers going to the development every day come from throughout the region, and the cities, counties, and school districts in which they live and commute also bear real costs. Without fiscal disparities, these cities have limited ability to recoup at least a portion of these costs, as all the new property tax revenues would go to the host community. One can go down and look at the original purposes of the fiscal disparities program and know that they have been maintained and achieved. Charles Weaver would be proud of what's happened. One example is to provide orderly development. We believe that on page 14 of this author's report, half of the developed cities are now contributors and half are recipients. That was not the case when the program began. The last paragraph on page 19 addresses the success showed for distribution of fiscal resources, showing that a small distribution makes a significant difference for the recipients. Our North Metro Mayors Association focuses mostly on city finances, so we're glad to see the school districts here today and also the counties because they're a very significant part of this program as well. As noted throughout the report, there are many complicated and independent factors at work driving how, when, and where growth occurs. We suggest that the legislature defer fiscal disparity program changes this year, accept the study, and to assess the findings over the next year before making any changes. We also suggest that any changes be considered in light of other proposals to address market value homestead credit changes, LGA changes, and other property tax system reforms. We stand ready and willing to work with the legislature, the governor, and other local officials to make our public financial structure simpler, more transparent, and targeted to better address citizen and business needs. With that, I want to thank the committee for this opportunity to address you, and thank you.
Thank you for your testimony, sir. I would say just by way of closing that this is a complicated issue that's not going to be changed this year that I can see. I mean, bills come and they will be heard if they have support for hearing. But we did want to hear this because I think that this is an issue that will come up next year. We have a property tax working group underway right now that will be making recommendations in January, February of next year. We have a local government aid working group that is doing the same thing, looking at what's happening with that program and hopefully making recommendations about how that might be changed. The governor also has a local government aid working group. So property taxes are absolutely on the table for next year. I think everybody's doing a lot of work, rolling up their sleeves, trying to figure out how can we improve this system. To those that came to testify, I would encourage you to look at the interplay and the interactions between all these different programs. Are the cities that benefit from fiscal disparities also LGA recipients? I think for the most part, yes. And I think that we should be looking at school equalization. That's why we're having education finance committee here, education finance hearings here in the tax committee. We have $8 billion in our property tax system. That's how much we raise in property taxes every year in the state of Minnesota. I'm not sure that we really have a good idea of where all that money comes from, where all of it is going, and whether it's being distributed and used to its best extent. So we all have a lot of work to do, not just the members of this committee, other members of the Senate, members of the community. We need your partnership in that. I urge you to participate in that property tax working group. Participate in the local government aid working group. That's where you're going to be heard because those recommendations will have a great deal of influence over the members of this committee. Senator Hall, do you want to make some final comments?
Yes, thank
You're
you.
Welcome.
First off, thank you for allowing us to hear this. This is very important to the communities I represent, Burnsville, Bloomington, Savage, Dakota County, and I know for the metro state or the regional area. I appreciate all of the testimony. We're trying to get to the bottom of this. If it's good, if it's right, if it's fair, I think we're all in. Yes, there are things like this that go on. Should we be a part of it? Shouldn't we be? I'm going to be looking to the chair and some of those committees that are going after this and taking a deeper look into it. You know, some people are talking about, well, you know, we don't have the airport. You don't have the noise either. We have to live there. No, we could live someplace else. We could all do that. It's like my youngest son who said, why am I the youngest? I wish I could be one of the older ones and have younger brothers and sisters. Well, that's who you are. Sometimes we have to live with that. But if this is helping in some areas, we want it to continue. If it isn't, and if it's putting a burden on other areas, and not because an area has their tax base is strong, it almost feels like if you're stronger, you're being taken advantage of. And so I appreciate, again, being able to sit down and look at this rationally, and let's get some good research and come up in the next year or so with some results. Thank you.
Senator Hall, and for members here, we will not have a hearing, at least as of yet, on Tuesday, February 21st. We may, and I'll let you know, Senator Marty, if we decide to change that plan. Wednesday, February 22nd, we will be looking at property tax relief bills. I expect to be talking about the statewide business property tax February 22nd. Also, February 23rd, Thursday, we have Senator Peterson's Senate File 780. We have a Senator DeCryfe bill. And Mr. Nauman will be back for round 3 on education finance. I'm looking forward to that. So with that, we are adjourned.